Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to LungCast. Today we have the opportunity to speak to two scientists in the area of gene editing. In 1953, the discovery of the twisted ladder structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, familiar to us today as the double helix, was pioneered by James Watson and Francis Crick, giving rise to the modern study of biology and genetics. They later received the Nobel Prize for this achievement in 1962. Another researcher, Arthur Kornberg, had been working on the project of DNA synthesis from about the early 1950s, and in 1953, when all five nucleotides could be synthesized in the lab, he decided to turn his focus to the remaining factors needed for DNA synthesis, that being the enzymes that assemble nucleotides into either DNA or RNA. He isolated the enzyme DNA polymerase from bacterial extracts and within a year successfully synthesized DNA in vitro for the first time. Kornberg was awarded the Nobel Prize for this outstanding achievement in 1956. These experiments and discoveries with DNA were all leading to the moment for the creation of recombinant DNA, or rDNA. rDNA essentially is DNA that has been created through the combination of elements from DNA from different organisms. By introducing genetic material from one organism to another, this discovery established the principles of modern genetics and was the basis for many future experiments. The 1980s was a point in the genetic engineering timeline that turned many genetic experiments into real-world products and ideas, changing the landscape of what was to come. Focusing on vaccines and treatments, the 1980s was a point in the genetic engineering timeline that turned many genetic experiments into real-world products and ideas, changing the landscape of what was to come. Focusing on vaccines and treatments, the 80s was a period that clearly displayed science's dedication to solving many human problems using our own DNA. In 2006, there was a breakthrough with using gene editing to find cancer treatments, and that breakthrough was Gardasil, a vaccine for use in the prevention of certain strains of human papillomavirus, or HPV. This was the first preventative cancer vaccine to reach the market. So what is the future of this technology? Now granted, that's a complicated question without a singular answer. In fact, past episodes of this podcast have highlighted the many ways our hopes for clinical innovation have taken shape in pulmonology. Monoclonal antibodies for asthma, precision lung cancer care, mRNA vaccines beyond COVID-19, and on and on and on. What about the future where disease could be altered altogether? For three decades, the concept of gene editing has captured the interest as well as the scrutiny of experts and prospective patients alike. CRISPR technology and its curative potential for some of the most persistent and deadly diseases right at the core of a person's DNA conveys a sense of borderline science fiction. If gene editing is the future of medicine, then it's certainly further away than our other futures of medicine. Or is it? Today's episode features Dr. Eric Gamesh and Dr. Natalie Rivera-Torres of the Christiana Care Gene Editing Institute at the Helen Graham Cancer Center in Newark, Delaware. Their years-long work into targeted gene editing has delivered breakthroughs in treatment capability for a variety of chronic diseases and cancer. And today they join to review how specific respiratory diseases may be addressed through these continually improving technologies. We hope you enjoy this look into the nearing future of medicine in this episode of LungCast. Thank you for joining me today. And I was wondering if we could start out just by each of you telling us a little bit about your career trajectory, how you got involved with molecular medicine and ultimately becoming involved in gene editing with the CRISPR technique.
So, Eric, do you want to go ahead and start, or should I go and start with this?
No, I can. I'll start. So I was actually trained at Rutgers as a microbiologist, and I sort of wormed my way through graduate school. And when I was a PhD student at the University of Florida, I had actually became involved in studying the process of homologous recombination. And at that time, it was really patterned in lower eukaryotes like fungus and yeast. And participated in some of the discoveries that led to which proteins do what when chromosomes are exchanged in a sort of normal process. And I think just got fascinated by the abilities that chromosomes have to align with each other and on occasion swap basic information, swap DNA. So that led to, I think, more of a bioengineering approach to not only study that process, but to control it and really have focused my laboratory, independent research lab, over the last 30 years trying to understand that process. It was a fascinating field, and we did a lot of, I think, very foundational work understanding the mechanism of how gene editing takes place. But it really was turned on its head when a couple of new tools like TALENs and zinc finger nucleases, and obviously now CRISPR, entered the fray. And once that happened, it became possible for us to do things genetically to cells, all the way from bacterial cells through human cells, that were probably in the last 10 years viewed to be completely impossible. So grabbed onto CRISPR and was able to assemble an excellent team, one of whom is the principal investigator of our lung cancer project, Natalie Rivera-Torres. So I'll maybe turn it over to her if she's ready to fill us in on her journey.
Sure. So I've been working under the mentorship of Dr. Eric Kimmich now for about 9 years. It's been a really interesting and nicely progressively growing career under him. I started off as an intern, and that developed into my master's, which led me into my PhD. And now I'm here leading and helping out develop better on the lung cancer platform within the Gene Editing Institute. Early on, I found that I had a passion for genetics. I understood that there was a need to better understand the genetics from the context that if we want to advance medicine, we have to understand how genes work and what targets we need to develop medical treatments for, or just any type of therapy. And that really led me to find my niche within the gene editing field as an alternative to current drugs or current therapies that had been developed and are currently being developed.
For many of our listeners, the world of gene editing and its potential clinical implications still remain a bit of a mystery. So I was hoping that one or both of you could give us a brief gene editing 101 overview just to kind of get us all on the same page if possible.
Sure, Dr. Rizzo. let me take a first shot at it, and then Natalia can fill in the gaps. This is usually how it works, by the way. I usually get out there, and then she cleans up the makes it all work really well.
It's a good team.
Right. She's quite a remarkable young scientist. It is true. Gene editing is a rather auspicious term, and it makes us think that we're going to be able to change a lot of things, including behavior, your hair color, even your physical appearance or your size. And the good news for everyone who's thinking that is it's absolutely false. The characteristics that the genes that control those kind of emotional and physical traits are so complex, it would require enormous amount of engineering to do the slightest maneuver. So we're pretty confident from the standpoint that that's not going to happen. But what we can do now is we can use the variety of these new genetic tools, including CRISPR, to act as a genetic spell checker. So if you think of the genes in your body on your chromosomes as a sentence, and each word of that sentence is a gene, the genes are composed of letters, and words are composed of letters. And if something is misspelled, so if we spell the word gene wrong and put an I instead of an E in the second position, under normal conditions, you'll use a word processing spell checker to identify it and repair it. And if people who have received emails from me know that I don't always use that function properly. But if you do use it and it spells the word correctly, you have essentially repaired the mutation or repaired the misspelling. Same thing is true in genetics. There are a variety of well-known diseases that are caused by misspellings of words, or in the analogy, missequences of genes. Until the advent of CRISPR, really, we could make these changes. In fact, Natalia used to do this pretty routinely as a graduate student and then as a young scientist. But we had not been able to do it at an efficiency that could have clinical implications, meaning that if we wanted to reverse the point mutation which causes sickle cell disease, there is a single letter or single base that's wrong in the gene, or a single letter in the word. And if we were able to do it with high precision, we would be able to reverse that kind of a genetic mutation and hopefully, if everything went well, make the patient better, because now instead of the mutation that causes sickle globin, the patient would now be making normal globin. So in general, gene editing is really like a genetic spell checker, that you can cut or paste or change words or single letters in words, analogous to changing the bases in a gene. So the excitement in the area that everyone's reading about and what we call the CRISPR revolution is because we can now do it at a percentage of cells in the body that could approach clinical benefit. And before the advent of these latest tools, that had not been possible.
And is CRISPR the main tool being used now? You mentioned other tools as well.
Yes, and there's a reason for that. Their earlier tools were cumbersome, hard to clone, hard to manipulate, but they did work. And in some cases, they actually work with a bit more precision. It's also great to be in this field because you get to work with great naming tools that have cool names, zinc finger nucleases, talons, mega nucleases, and of course, CRISPR. So I think it's fair to say that CRISPR has been chosen primarily because it is the easiest to produce. And something I'll embarrass him now that I learned from Dr. Rizzo in developing lung cancer treatments is, you better be able to make enough of a drug to be successful in human patients. And while talons and zinc fingers are wonderful research tools, CRISPR is the one we believe that can be scaled up enough to produce. So it is the main one, not only scientifically being the easiest to utilize inside the laboratory, it's actually one with the most promise because we could actually scale it up. So it could be used successfully in human trials.
Maybe before we get to Natalia, I know I did want to ask you about your perspective on discussing the societal and ethical concerns around gene editing. You've touched on that a little bit, but I believe things have changed a bit over the last couple of decades, and you've had a pretty good perspective on that.
Yes, and I think you're right. I think all of us who work in this field have been rolling along, we think producing some pretty good results, and then the world gets jolted by someone that goes off the rails. And it's happened a couple times. For the most part, the categories of gene editing are numerous, but really fall into two general ones. The first one is germinal cell gene editing, and that's where you would actually use tools to change the DNA of a sperm, an egg, or an oocyte. And therefore, when you did that, you would create a germline change that the offspring would then inherit. That is forbidden in this country. We are ethically opposed to that. And I would say 99% of the patients, the scientists would be probably 99% of patients too, frankly, but 99% of scientists as well. The other type is where you take a skin cell or a cell, a tumor cell, as we're doing, and utilize CRISPR to disable it or to change the DNA so it has some other reaction. And Natalia will probably expand on that. And that's called somatic gene editing, so that whatever changes are made in that cell, whether it's in the skin or the tumor, or the liver, the heart, are specific and permanent for that particular cell, but they do not get passed on to your offspring. And so their FDA watches that extremely carefully. And You know, the one example that everyone points to, which did send the world on its end, was when CRISPR was used in China about 3 years ago by someone who actually used an in vitro fertilized egg as a target, and CRISPR was used to modify the receptor, oddly enough, for the AIDS virus. And it worked. The eggs were then implanted, and the children, they were twins, believe it or not, is I think it's pretty common in vitro fertilization. And they're both perfectly normal. But the act of how it was done, unregulated, kind of at a fertilization, vitro fertilization clinic in China, just set the world on its ear. So I think we've learned a lot. We've learned the dangers, and we are ethically opposed to that. But every once in a while, someone will slip through, and with no regulations surrounding certain things, things can get problematic. The vast majority of all of the work going on, whether it's in oncology, inherited diseases, infectious diseases, even diagnostics, is focused only on cells that are of the somatic origin.
Very good. Well, I'm proud to say that both of you are currently working at my home institution at our NCI-designated Community Cancer Center, Helen Graham Center at ChristianaCare in Newark, Delaware. So maybe now you can tell us a little bit more about the actual ongoing research around lung cancer that you're doing there and how you're interacting with our clinical teams and medical oncologists while this is being done.
Yeah, sure. That being at the Helen Graham Cancer Center has been really an advantage to the development of our platform. I think that if we would have been in any other site different to the Cancer Center, things would have not been progressing as fast and as exciting as they are currently at the Gene Editing Institute. So early on when the lab joined the Helen Graham Cancer Center, one of our missions was to really get involved with the clinical setting and with the clinicians. And at that time, Dr. Petrelli, who is the director at the Cancer Center, approached Dr. Kimmich saying, well, you know, let's find a target. Let's find what we can work on that we need. There is a need to find better treatments for, and that just so happened to be lung cancer. And we started talking with the clinicians and the lung specialists at the Cancer Center, and we came up with the idea that we were going to go after the NRF2 gene. And what's really peculiar about the NRF2 gene is that it's associated with chemo resistance. So knowing a molecular target that had not been well studied for lung cancer and having the backup of the clinicians really led us move forward into what we wanted to do and kind of find a way, how can we utilize our knowledge of CRISPR in a clinical platform? So our overall idea is that by utilizing this site specificity that CRISPR gives and its advantages over other types of gene editing platforms, we would be able to disrupt this NRF2, pretty much making it non-functional and therefore letting the lung cancer cells regain their sensitivity to chemotherapy, because that is one of the major problems with lung cancer patients is that there's not much treatment, and the treatment that there is does not give that much of an advantage of survival, or at least currently. You know, we really want to get to the next level of treatment, and that's where we walk in. We did a little bit of exploring, trying to find what is the best way to really develop a CRISPR platform for lung cancer that is not just the basic approach of disrupting the gene in an uncontrolled fashion. And one of our graduate students at that time, who is now a research scientist in the institute, found a specific mutation, just like Dr. Kimmich mentioned earlier on during his portion, that was giving this specific gene a misspell. It was just one single base that creates a new CRISPR site. So not only could we utilize CRISPR to disable the gene, but we were also being able now to discriminate between cancer cells and non-cancerous cells. Because that is one question we would always get from the clinicians is like, oh, this idea is great, but you know, you don't want to go targeting or inhibiting the function of NRF2 in any cell because in a normal cell, NRF2 is important for many function and specifically for cytoprotective and detoxifying mechanisms that the cells have. So we didn't want to affect the normal, but we want it to really affect more the cancerous or the mutation type. And we've been working now on this approach for about 3 to 4 years, and we've been successful in showing that this new site or a mutation that CRISPR is specific to only cutting that, and we've presented to the FDA in our Interact meeting, and that site specificity was really what caught the FDA's attention, that we were able to discriminate between cancer and non-cancer. Another thing that we've been able to also accomplish is deciding on the route of delivery, because that's another thing that we have to think about when we're designing new treatment, is what is the best way to deliver, or what's the most innovative way to deliver. And our approach is going to be through a intratumoral injection of a virus that carries this CRISPR-Cas9 platform, and then you don't have to worry about systemic delivery or the effect on the system itself of the patient, since we know they are in very critical stages of life when they end up needing alternative methods of treatment. So that's pretty much what we've been able to accomplish in the last couple of years. We're getting ready now to move into pre-IND stages. We've developed various models of animal models to study this lung cancer approach. We were lucky enough to find that Jackson Laboratories and NCI have PDX samples of our mutation of interest. So not only are we studying this from the context of cell lines in vitro, but we're also being able to use primary samples to show our proof of concept that this is possible, and then we're a step closer to get into patients.
Do you think this is going to be across different types of lung cancer? Are you looking at squamous cell, adenocarcinoma, things of that nature, or we don't know for sure yet?
Yes. So right now we're focusing on squamous cell carcinoma. The early on work was on adenocarcinoma, but the one thing that really switched us to focus on this squamous cell carcinoma was, first of all, this specific mutation is in squamous cell carcinoma, but also squamous cell carcinoma has less treatments and has been less researched than adenocarcinoma. So we really wanted to find our niche in the realm of where treatment was really needed. Because once we can show that this works in squamous cell carcinoma, we can move it on into adenocarcinoma, and that would probably be our next target or our next approach. It is transferable between both types of cancers, but currently squamous cell is our target.
Yeah, I can add just a little bit there. Natalia explained it very well. I think from a perspective of a kind of a pioneering treatment here, a high-risk, high-reward type of treatment, we felt we wanted to identify a particular subset of patients that for which there is really not much hope. We certainly, and again, as Natalia had mentioned, benefited enormously from being around the oncology groups within the cancer center. I think we all knew almost nothing about cancer, frankly, until we learned from the oncologists. And it's something that I would strongly urge my colleagues in the basic sciences to do, even just if you go to grand rounds and listen to the challenges. One of the things that is often said, and one of the terms often used, is unmet medical need. And now there are some very novel and wonderful new treatments for lung cancer, but pretty much 25% of the patients are really going to struggle with anything. And as harsh as chemo is, and we know we don't want to use chemo, all that stuff, it still is part of the regime. So we selected a group of patients that were basically out of hope, and we thought we would test this whole idea there, in these courageous individuals. And as Natalia mentioned, if this did seem to be at least safe, remember the first round is about safety. And doesn't cause a really negative response, then we can start thinking about ramping it up, because the work that Natalia and Kelly Baines did and the other molecular biologists, we We've actually developed a CRISPR approach to target a wider span of lung cancer subtypes. So that's all kind of in the hopper right now, as they say. And it's, it, you know, it, it, if the first thing goes well and we're cautious, and we really are after very low hanging fruit, we realize this is an innovative thing. So we're doing very methodical, expectations low, clinical endpoints will be modest. But I think we're learning so much as we go that if this works, then it would become the basis for a lot of treatments in various types of solid tumors in the oncology space.
So just to keep it clear in my mind, because this is relatively new to me as well, what if you take this from the bench to translating it clinically, your hope is that if a patient is diagnosed with advanced squamous cell carcinoma, early on, they'll be able to be tested to see if they have this genetic defect that makes them non-responsive to chemotherapy, and you may have be able to develop and target that to make them more responsive to the therapy once they get it. I'm assuming this is mainly cisplatin-based yep. chemotherapy you're talking about.
Yes, that right. Carboplatin. We've also looked at paclitaxel response as well, but that that's exactly right. NRF2 is actually one of the genes that is sequenced in the panels, so we will know from the tumor itself whether or not it's there. You know, we have had a great deal of debate, just to give you guys some inside baseball on how we think about this stuff, with help from our clinician team and our surgical residents, which are embedded in GEI. So it's a really nice thing. Dr. Petrelli and Christiana Care allowed us to have surgical residents in the lab, other than when they're actually operating, and we've had a great opportunity to learn even more than we did before, just by being in the cancer center. But we've decided to do a direct injection using a bronchoscope, again primarily because we did not want to sort of expose the patient to systemic delivery of these biomolecules. Even though that's been done quite successfully, by the way, recently, we still want to keep things very modest. So while the initial target is definitely a tumor that has a specific mutation in the NRF2 gene, because we're doing direct injection, it is less challenging that we would have to worry about our biotherapeutic going other places. We're kind of doing and that's what I meant, we're doing the most ultimate and ultra conservative approach so far, just to be sure we understand the process. As I've learned from you, Dr. Rizzo, there won't be a paucity of, unfortunately, lung cancer patients coming downstream, although certainly the statistics and the work of the ALA and others have done a remarkable job in reducing the numbers overall. That's certainly been, but I don't think we'll be lacking patients for this kind of therapy, unfortunately.
No, I tend to agree with you, unfortunately, as well. So I guess the other question I have is that, I mean, this sounds quite promising in for as lung cancer, squamous lung cancer. And then you said you might be able to then translate this into the more targeted chemotherapies that use the adenocarcinoma, and maybe even be able to detect whether immune therapies might be affected by certain gene changes. Is that something you're thinking about or wondering about?
Yeah, I'll turn that over to Natalia, but just to tee it up, she's actually moved ahead on looking at esophageal cancer as another target again, because we can deliver it. But Natalia, you may want to tell them about kind of the iterations of the new forms of CRISPR that will allow us to be that sort of targeted thing. And it's a technology development that's moving forward inside the Institute.
Yeah, no, definitely. There is many different iterations, just as Dr. Kamech mentioned, that we are internally developing as alternative ways to utilize gene editing tools, specifically CRISPR, to target these specific mutations, and not necessarily only in the squamous cell carcinoma, but that open up the realm of adenocarcinoma. And right now we're really focusing on utilizing specific mutations that we find that give us the specificity, but also combining them with lesser well-defined mutations or novel mutations within genes where we can do combinations approach where we can target a mutation and also target a non-mutation site, but the specificity is still maintained. We're also looking into utilizing more than one CRISPR site at the time. So the when we're disabling the gene, it's a little bit more efficient depending on the type of mutation that we're after, because there are mutations where we have to achieve a certain level of efficacy or efficiency of disruption in order to produce a clinical outcome. Thankfully, so far, we've seen within the squamous cell carcinoma background and the adenocarcinoma background that within the 20 to 40% is good enough for us to see the or disruption of the gene to see the gain of sensitivity again towards chemotherapy, but that won't necessarily be applicable to all types of mutations. There are mutations that are driver mutations that are a little bit more harsher, more stronger, and any type of background that is left behind still maintains that resistant mechanism that the cancer cells have. So we're trying to find alternatives of mixing and matching mechanisms and pathways that are disrupted within these cancer cells for our benefit of knocking out the genes within those pathways. And always the idea is to get a clinical outcome where there's more of a benefit and most likely it's going to be the gain of chemosensitivity without compromising the need of other types of treatments or new types of treatments in combination. So really what we want to achieve is to either the CRISPR outcome to be as beneficial as the current treatments are, where we won't have to do the combination of standard chemotherapy with the gene editing approach, or where when there is that combination, there is even a better outcome than when the standard treatment of care is utilized. And the other line of thinking is for the cancers that are operable, if we or are inoperable, that we can get them to a stage where the tumor becomes operable and therefore the tumor burden can be reduced and therefore extend the life or enhance the life or the quality of life of the patients at the time.
Right. Well, this sounds very exciting, especially for this group of people, as you said, who have limited options for their treatment, and the treatment is not always that successful. Is the work you need to do, is this tissue sample needed? Have you done anything with circulating tumor DNA from blood specimens, or is this going to be tissue-based?
So right now we're focusing on tissue-based. We're focusing on the primary cells that are involved within the tumors themselves. We understand that there are certain limitations with finding these tumor samples for these specific types of mutations that we're interested in. Like I mentioned before, we're working with Jackson Labs laboratory repository, and we're also working with the NCI tumor repository. The Cancer Center has its own repository of tumor samples that they collect, and as now the expansion of the utilizing sequencing as a also in a way a predetermining standard of care where more tumors and more people are getting their tumors sequenced to better find treatment options that will expand our platform. And also currently the FDA is really pushing for all of these types of platforms to be tested in tumor samples or what we call PDX or patient-derived xenograft models, because they are one of the best representative clinical studies within what could look like for the patient population. Cell lines and established cell lines are great. That's where we develop and just the science field, scientific world and the gene editing field as itself develops most of its platforms. But when we can show that it works in a tumor that was derived from a patient, that is the best scenario that we can have.
Yeah, and let me just add on to that briefly. That was really, really well explained. But I, you know, this sounds so easy to do. And that is that, you know, you get a tumor sample and Christiana Care under Dr. Petrelli's really remarkable leadership has pioneered the availability of such tumors, and that's great. The problem is that these tumors oftentimes don't grow in mice very well. And so while it sounds like it's, to make a bad joke, the best laid plans of mice and men, right? You actually end up taking a tumor sample and implanting in a mouse. And we've had an example where it did not move for 100 days. We were about a week away from ending that experiment, and suddenly it started to grow, and now it's one of our best models. So manipulation of cells outside the environment from which they came is actually quite challenging. By default, we're getting really good at it. I wish we weren't good at it, but because that means we've been having to deal with it. So, and I think it kind of raises to a real challenge that people think that, well, you just shoot up a mouse or you look for toxicity. But even creating the model itself, it took us a long time. And it took some really great patience, far more than I had from some of the team to keep it going. Now we have some incredibly good models, and I believe we'll not only be able to test this version of CRISPR, but a variety of ones that that are ready to be. And in fact, we would obviously make these models available to other folks testing other types of models around. But it is one of that that sort of inside baseball thing that making mouse models is quite a challenge, and yet it is very, very important for obviously testing anything that's headed toward a human application.
Well, you may have already mentioned this. I was going to ask what you thought might be changing in the field the next 5 to 10 years, but also when you thought your clinical application to patients might come to fruition. Is there a timeline you envision for this, and if this has gone on in the field as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, we certainly see within the next 18 months that this will be probably available to patients, at least at the safety trial level, perhaps before. And as you know, it's very difficult to say that because who would have thought we'd have a pandemic, right? Our lab was in the worst possible space as we move this forward, because by definition, cancer patients have an incredible chance of being infectious. So we sometimes had 2 people allowed per day in the lab. So the guys would rotate all the way through the night to continue the work and almost heroic efforts. And we did lose a little bit of time. But the other thing that's kind of curious about the timeline, and I know Natalia is going to smile and probably pull her hair out when I say this, is because the FDA doesn't quite know what to ask yet about CRISPR. And so, you know, there's a great analogy, and I have a wonderful photo of this, that we are building the plane while we're flying it. And that really is a true analogy. We follow carefully what goes on at the FDA. We've argued before them. We have informal meetings, formal meetings. And as Natalia said, we're getting closer and closer to the penultimate meeting, which is kind of the one that tells you what you have to do to finish. And that's all oftentimes a very short time. But someone will develop a new technique to look for sites where CRISPR isn't supposed to cut, but is cutting. So we could spend 6 months, and in fact, not we could, we actually did spend 6 months showing from a genetic standpoint, our approach is completely safe. Someone could come up with something and publish it, and suddenly the FDA says, oh, by the way, you have to do this too. Right. So while this is a very exciting, innovative, and there's lots of activity around the area, which makes us really happy, lots of money flowing in and stuff, the process of actually getting it approved is almost a little bit of the Wild West yet, simply because they don't understand what they don't understand. And that's not a knock against them. It's a knock about everybody being as prudent and careful as possible. And we're, because of Christiana, as those of us who work her know, it is about the patient, not the technology. And so we are bending over backward to make sure this is a safe approach, at least as it moves its way through its first safety trials.
Natalia, any other comments?
No, I think Dr. Kamach has summarized it really well. A lot of people think, well, you know, you want to get into the patient and you want to show it works 100%. And most importantly, what our focus is not only showing that it works from the context of helping the patient gain chemosensitivity, but from the context of moving the gene editing field as a whole forward, we want to show that gene editing in an intratumoral injection is safe. Because there are other clinical trials out there that are being showing the usage of CRISPR, but not necessarily in the intratumoral injection context. So showing that safety is achievable is going to definitely open the platform for many other targets and many other studies to be able to move forward in. Even ourselves, I mean, we're moving one line of research currently, which is this lung squamous carcinoma R34G platform, but we already have 3 to 4 pipelines ready to go because all we need to really show is safety. And I think that is really what we want to focus, because once we show safety, really there's no limit of what we can do. It's been a really interesting experience working with the FDA, because even the way that we approach experiments from the basic research context to the more clinical patient driven FDA standards is a little bit different, but it's been a really rewarding and satisfying time for all of the people involved in it. We've learned a lot, and there's definitely a lot to do because there hasn't been a well-established pipeline or platform from the FDA standpoint of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable when it comes to gene editing, or more specifically using CRISPR. We've had to add a little bit extra more work and extra layers of showing things that for us would be basic. But for the FDA, we have to show them 3 different platforms or 3 different types of approach. And one of those have been when it's considered the off-target analysis, which is really what most people hear about when it comes to gene editing. It's not just of how efficiently it works on site, how great it is, and how easy it is for scientists to manipulate the sequences that we want to target. But, oh, well, can you talk about the off-target? And we as a lab always say, well, you know, there's much more than just talking about the off target, but that seems to be the 2 words that people always focus when it comes to gene editing. And we've definitely felt the push from the FDA. And so far, all of our work, we've had to do 3 different platforms just to study the off targets, 1 in silico and 2 platforms in vitro, where we're looking at over 600 potential targets. Everything's come down to show that there's only 1 potential site that we could be affecting, and that potential site is a non-coding region. So after all, we were right, we're on track, but because of the unknown and because there hasn't been those well-established safety protocols yet, because there's not a lot of studies ongoing, we are feeling the burn, but we know that our contribution is going to help our lab and other labs that want to move CRISPR into the clinic.
Great. You certainly opened a window into some of the mysteries, but you've also pointed out a lot more complexities in there in gene editing and CRISPR. So I'm hoping, certainly have piqued my interest and hopefully our listeners as well. And I want to thank you both for taking the time today. And it sounds like you have a very good collaborative group at the Helen Graham Center. So thank you again.
Great pleasure, Dr. Rizzo. Thanks for the invitation. And to Stacy and Kevin, thanks so much for helping out on the production.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity to talk about the great work that we're doing.
Thanks again to Drs. Kamish and Rivera-Torres for highlighting their lab's contribution to CRISPR and gene editing, and their willingness to share such interesting developments with our listeners. If you're interested in hearing about other advances in respiratory medicine, check out our episodes on biologic breakthroughs with Dr. Mario Castro and lung cancer precision medicine with Dr. Andrea Mazzocchi. For more respiratory news, insights, and resources, be sure to check out hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.